Hi, welcome back to the TT Wine Explorer podcast. I'm Tanya Tomaszewska. For those new to the show, this podcast series is about my adventures in the wide world of wine. It's about my journey to learn more about wine and wine travel, and why we like wine so much, why we want to keep trying more. And this is all through my lens as a former banking lawyer and everyday wine enthusiast turned wine professional and committed cork dork. I'm a traveler, a reader, and a talker, and so the best way for me to understand and learn things is through tasting and through conversations. And so, each one of my podcast episodes is a discussion with someone who I've met along the way. And for those who may be wondering, at this stage, my approach has been that my episodes are not sponsored by anyone, well, other than me. Each conversation which you've heard is a result of my contacting a guest and asking if they'll come onto my show to share their story, their thoughts, and their views. This podcast project is all off my own bat. But if there's a day in the future that I make an episode which is sponsored or part of a formal collaboration, I'll make that clear. I'm so grateful to everyone who's made the time to be my guest so far. And that deep gratitude extends to my guest today, John Claridis. John is the founder and owner of Marquis Wine Cellars. Located in central Vancouver, Marquis was established more than 30 years ago and is the preeminent premium wine store of British Columbia. There are a lot of things which I really like about Marquis. The shop has some very cool, exclusive wine selections from different parts all over the world, which they bring in, and which I really can't see anywhere else in our British Columbia market. There's an amazing array of collector wines and specialty items, but also a diverse selection of everyday wines, each of which I know will be solid when I buy them, even if I haven't tasted them before. I think that there are more than 2,000 selections of beverages on offer at Marquis. Marquis offers weekly tastings, which you can drop by to have a taste and a chat with a product owner or knowledgeable agent to learn more about what's being poured. Marquis also has a lot of space to wander in the aisles so that you can take your time and immerse yourself in the offerings, not feel rushed or jammed in with other people around you. And Marquis is also a conduit of meeting new wine friends, be they Marquis team members, present or alumni, or other wine exploring enthusiasts. They say that success doesn't happen overnight, or that overnight success is 20 years in the making. All of what I've described to you about Marquis, I think, is a result of years of hard work, creating a vision, having a plan, and navigating the world of a business in the retail space, and in the context of a highly regulated landscape and changing consumer tastes and demands. I thought that John would be an excellent person to have on the show to share his knowledge and learning not only around building a retail wine store business from scratch, but also about building and preserving a brand in the retail segment of the wine industry. I first met John about 6 or 7 years ago now, when I was first jumping into this crazy wine adventure of mine. What struck me at the time was that John was great about offering concise advice about what to try to focus on and my next steps. John understands what it means to start pretty much from ground zero in terms of embarking upon a completely new path and trying to make a business out of it. Since then, I've frequently connected with John and his Marquis team in connection with various wine tastings and wine gift campaign projects, which I work on for some of my clients. Or often, it's just when I'm strolling down the Marquis aisles looking for my own bottle to try and learn from. And from time to time, John and I catch up over pizza and a glass of wine to discuss not only wine news, but also what's going on in our city of Vancouver and the world at large. I hope that you enjoy my discussion with John Claridis today. Let's fly. Hi, John. Welcome to the TT Wine Explorer podcast.
Tanya, thanks for having me. Great introduction.
Thank you so much. So I'd like to begin with how this all started for you. How did you get into this business? You know, in the past, you've told me a few things about your parents' story about arriving in Canada. Are these things all connected? Can you share a little bit about your background?
Sure. Absolutely. They're all connected. You think sometimes you think they're not, but then, you know, as you get older and reflect, you go, these pebbles or these stones set by your parents, of course, set the foundation to what you have today. So, how we started, I remember the day vividly. It was February 1986. Sitting at the table, lunch table at my parents' house, having coffee. My dad's reading the newspaper. I'm reading the sports scores, and he sees this article in the newspaper about how Mark Anthony Group and Mission Hill were allowed to open off-site wine shops. And they were selling franchises. And he goes, hey, what do you think of this? And I said, I read the article. Oh, it looks like a good idea. So we had actually a vacant piece of property on Davie Street that we owned. And we said, hey, let's try it. So we applied. And that was in, I think, February, March of 1986. And that was my first lesson of government bureaucracy and slowness, because we thought we could be open for Expo, and we missed all of Expo. I missed all of Expo and opened in November of 1986.
Wow.
And we thought, okay, this is going to be a great business. First day of sales, I think it was under $100.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And there are 12 of us. There are, 11 other people that also applied for these licenses. Some are sort of still around. Some have been sold. Most have been sold and turned into Everything Wines. Liberty has a couple of them. And then there's the last remnants of one is, of course, mine, Marquis, and then the Broadway shop at Broadway and McDonald.
And so when you, and we'll get to some, the regulatory aspects a little bit later as well. And thanks for raising it now. When you opened, that day that you had the $100 sales, in general terms for people who weren't maybe of legal drinking age at that time, can you share a little bit, like what was the landscape? You mentioned a little bit about, limited number of licenses, but what was in your shop? What could you sell and who were your customers, at that time?
What could I sell? We were only allowed to sell Mission Hill wine, Okanagan cider, which they owned, and a product which only old guys like me remember is California Cooler. Mm-hmm. And California Cooler was absolutely was the first cooler out there. And Mission Hill, Mark Anthony Group, had the bottling rights and distribution for it. And it was absolutely huge. And then that shot off to Bartles and James, and then the RTD beverage industry that we have today.
Right.
But that's the only three products. Interestingly enough, most of the grapes that were in these Mission Hill wines, private reserves and so on, were grapes from Washington, Oregon, and California. We had things like Deschonac, Chelwah, Marischal Foch, Cayuga, Okanagan Riesling, winter hardy grapes that actually weren't that very good, weren't good at all. But, they were $6-$7 a bottle. Mm-hmm. We also sold, unbeknownst to me, a product called Caravella Ruby Red. And that was, I think it was Caravella Ruby Red. Anyway, that was the drink that most of the alcoholics drank.
And it sounds like a mix of wine and port.
Oh, it was bad. It was bad. And on Sundays, we sold a lot of it because we were the only liquor store open.
Oh, right. Sunday. Of course. Everything used to be closed on Sundays.
Right,
so you were able to stay open.
Right. And the landscape was such that you could go to a restaurant, but you couldn't have a beer. You had to have food, but food was defined by the liquor board because the government, of course, knows it all.
So John, you were talking about, so that's interesting because in previous conversations with my colleague, Mark Hicken, who we've talked about the vestiges and the hangover of Prohibition era and what that means for retail. And I think a lot of people don't know what that meant in terms of, having to have wine with a meal. But then, step two to today in your store, as I mentioned, has 2,000, more selections. Going back to that time, what were some of the steps that you got to grow? How were you able to grow out of those initial offerings? Was it regulatory change or were you able to do something with your business that you could go and expand your portfolio?
We had to fight. My dad was in his, dad's still alive. He's 97. He's been in his 60s. So basically my age now. And we're still fighting the fight, but we had to fight to get additional BC products, had to fight to get an internet site, had to fight to get advertising, had to fight to get delivery. The in-store tastings, pouring off-site. I mean, it was just, the list was endless.
And so for the fight, was it something that you had to do or was it also within the space, other parties in the retail space that there was this erosion and then finally, or, you know, how did you get to it today?
There are very few other parties in the retail space. So there was 12 original private wine stores, and then what was called beer and all the private liquor stores, or mm-hmm. beer and wine stores. Mm-hmm. So the pub association was very successful in lobbying the government. So there was a thing called off sales. So if all the liquor stores were closed, you could walk into a pub or a strip bar and said, I need a case of beer. And they'd sell you a case of beer. And then you go off to the party, but you couldn't get wine, couldn't get anything else. It was a case of beer. Then they offered, okay, we can get cider. Then they said, oh God, we're so busy, we need a separate store. So the separate store had to be physically beside the pub. And the two licenses were attached. And then they lobbied and lobbied, lobbied. You know, they got separate stores. They got cider. They got beer. Sorry. They had wine, port. And then they detached the stores from the pub because sometimes it was hard to get a business next door. And then if you sold your pub, you had to sell your beer and wine store license. And then they detached all those. So they had a pretty powerful lobby group. But, you know, we, on the other hand, we were fairly active in pushing the government to get additional product. And that was only done by NAFTA and the GATT running. It was not the benevolence of any government or the Mark Anthony Group or any other organization, because the government can't think out of their own box.
So, and then they had trade partners and they had arrangements. So they had to make it, equality on the shelves for products within the trade agreement area. Just switching gears a little bit from inside the shop and what you were able to bring in from local products to where you have developed and grown. So one of the things that Marquis is known for is your premium wine selection. And amongst that, you have a lot of wines which you have brought in exclusively to your store from lots of places in the world and iconic wine regions, you know, Grower Champagne, Chablis, the Rhone, California, Australia. Can you just provide a little bit of a snapshot as to, you know, how this started and how you identify the producers that you like to bring in? I mean, do you go to the region, you visit ones, you go back, you meet some of their friends, you know, how do you do this and how do you build on it?
Well, back in the day, there were, you know, the internet wasn't around. And the only books, there was a couple of books out by Robert Parker, Top California Chardonnays, Top California Cabernet. So I just went through that book and started calling people, saying, hey, I'm coming to California. This is who I am. And they go, sure, come and meet me. And came down and just started knocking on doors. One particular person, it was funny, I phoned Jim Clendenin up, who has now since passed away from Obonkley Mine. He basically tore a strip off of me, saying I wasn't around. You know, where were you in 1982 when I started? Well, I said, dude, I was 22 years old, no private stores, yeah, no nothing. And he's was a pretty glib person. And he was like, okay, you can come by. I have an allocation for you, right? So, you know, you just had to knock on doors.
You know, cold calling bottles and getting out there, door knocking. Yeah,
cold calling and, you know, renting a car, and there was no GPS. And, you know, you got to get instructions over the phone, or you write them down. Knocked on a few wrong doors over the years and got lost many times. Mm-hmm. And you just do that. That's how you start. That's what you do.
And I guess you keep building on the relationship. So you go back to the regions, you see your existing partners, and then you will add some more to the mix.
Exactly.
One of your recent trips, I know you've got Greek heritage and you've been to Greece a few times recently. And I think you've had the opportunity to try some wine, and I think you bring in some to Marquis, and I hope you bring in more. But can you just share a little bit about, you know, what you're finding exciting about the Greek wine scene right now? You know, for people maybe who are familiar with Greek varieties or people who've never tried Greek wine, what they can look for, what they can expect?
You know, here's the interesting thing about Greek wines. They're on the same trajectory as Italian wines 30 years ago. Everybody knew Chianti in a flask. And Suave was Bola. Bola Suave was the two big brands. When we look at Italy today, so people have great stories of getting absolutely roaring drunk on Retsina and having really bad hangovers. And that's the analogy I draw. Greek wines, holy crap, are they ever good. So what do they have? They have indigenous grape varieties that no one in the world has. They're in Greece. That's it. I mean, it's hard to find Xenomavro anywhere else, but you can find Grüner Veltliner in California and in Washington State. You kind of can see what Europe was like back then. There's a lot of, it's not as developed. It's got a little rustic note to it. And that's what I like about it. You know, the wine regions aren't quite as developed as they say Napa Valley with wayfinding signs. They're there. You can get there, but they just don't have that infrastructure. So it's a little bit on the raw side, which I like, but great skill, great wineries and great wines and a cool climate and a great climate too.
So are there, are they mainly individual small producers, I mean, aside for things like Retsina, but, or are there collections of communes, as well?
More small producers. Greece, I mean, if you know any Greeks, they're a bit of an iconoclastic, very proud people, and they love their independence. You know, if you know the history of Greece, they've been conquered quite a few times over the centuries. Of course, the Ottomans, Germans, communists took over in the early 70s. So they'd like, Greeks only been a country since 1860, I believe. So, you know, they like their independent and they're fiercely independent people. So that is their strength. I was in Greece last year and I've ordered several hundreds of cases of wine that are coming in. And they're all, here's the beauty of it. They're all like $40 and under. Mm-hmm, so there's some there's some real value there. If I did that in Burgundy, I could buy a house in Shaughnessy. 400 cases worth of wine.
Aside, when you talk about bringing wine from Greece, you know, practically speaking, and you know, aside from, I'll just call it the logjam that happens when wine lands in, you know, the port of Vancouver. Before that point, you know, how lengthy a process is that? You know, I guess you order in advance, it comes on a ship. You know, how do you plan as a store your inventory? So are you buying, how far ahead, you know, aside from, you know, our LDB warehousing issues, let's just say clearing here. But before that, buying your product from, you know, the other side of the oceans, how do you plan for that?
It's a year. You know, I was in Greece last year in June, July. So the wines are just coming in now. So they'll be here for spring, summer. So it's a year. We don't ship in the summer months, even though we use refrigerated containers. Greece in the summer is painfully hot. And we use refrigerated trucks to pick up stuff. You can trust France to say, hey, pick my Burgundies up or my Bordeaux's up or my Rhone in a refrigerated truck from Hillebrand. Greece? Yeah, not so much. So
you're not sure.
So, you know, we avoid the summer months and we'll ship in the fall for arrival in spring of the fall, you know, the following year.
Right. So, you know, at least a year ahead and then based on how you feel a producer is showing and what you're tasting. That's fascinating. I look forward to trying some more. I thought we could shift now shift from looking at the supply side of your business in terms of, you know, we've talked a little bit about the restrictions where you came from and how you bring in wine. But maybe let's talk a little bit about the buy side, the demand side, the consumer side. So, you know, in terms of a bricks and mortar context, and we'll talk about digital separately, but in terms of you've got one shop and you're in central Vancouver, you've got a lot of wine there. You know, how do you assess what the consumers, what your consumers want? I mean, I expect there's a balance between educating the consumer with what you have, let's say, you know, Greek wines or everyday other wines that may be more recognizable to those who aren't familiar with Greek wines, but also listening and learning from the computer, from the consumer. So, you know, in terms of your own business plan or your sales or your patterns, your shop, You know, how do you describe this kind of seller-customer relationship? Is it symbiotic, or, you know, how does it work? Or does it depend on the kind of wines?
I think it's a combination of all three. I don't think there's a wine in the store I wouldn't drink, right? My staff, obviously I don't do all the buying for everything because it's just the store's gotten too big. But my staff, my team has, we have the customer in mind. The question is, would I drink this? If yes, then I can recommend it. If I wouldn't want to drink it, I'm not recommending it to my customer. If we don't have a product, we'll send them to another store. Here's what I learned about the wine industry is that really it's people buy stuff that they know, because to spend $30 or $40 on something they don't know is a bit of a gamble for them. So, better the devil than the devil you don't know, right? So if we can build a relationship with the customer as a trusted source, and have a few bottles open saying, hey, here's a new Cote de Rhone, here's a new Gruner Veltliner, here's a Riesling. What do you think? Oh, I've never had this before. This is really good. And you plant the seed in their mind. Trust me, earning the trust of a customer is really, really hard, and losing it is like speed of light. So there's no reason for me to sell something or suggest something to a customer that I wouldn't drink, and ask them what they like. Right. And if they're open to something, great. If they're not, that's their choice. They're the customer.
And at the bottom line, it has to be delicious. So, you have a lot of experience in wine, and so you know what's delicious no matter what the price point is.
You got to listen to the customer. You want red or white? What are you having for dinner? How much do you want to spend? What country? Do you like this? Do you like that? There is a place I draw the line on, and it's all the natural wine phenomena. And many of those wines are absolutely flawed, technically flawed, and they're not very good.
And so they may not be doing a service to the customer who may not be familiar with the background of why that wine was made that way, and that may not have been stabilized or not showing in, an ideal
way. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm very, very careful on what I bring in that, and we'll personally taste them. What we are big on, and we were actually the first store in British Columbia, is biodynamic wines, and organic wines, and Luc Raisonnet. So I believe that in the wine business, and healthy plant, healthy life, and you can taste it in the wines. So we've been a big proponent on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you can taste off the purity and the rusticity and elegance all in one, I find. I'm not guaranteed, of course, but with good winemaking and farming. And on other episodes of this podcast with a number of people who've talked about, you cannot have great wine without great grapes, and that's from great farming, but also the blue zones and the living around it. So, so thanks for reminding me about, you're bringing in biodynamic and organic wines is not something new for you. you've been doing it for a while, and that the producers have been, many producers have essentially been making wine this way. So that's, part of the ancient old world approach. But getting back maybe to the new world, which is, in addition to bricks and mortar, we have the rise of the digital marketplace and digital space, particularly during COVID, with sales of wine, but before. And I know, or it seems to me that you launched a new overhaul of your website recently. I think it looks great. I liked your website before, but I know you've worked on that. So, in broad terms, can you share a little bit about, in the context of your business, a very strong bricks and mortar retail shop, your online platform, have you found, does that bring in new people, or is that your existing base, or a combination, or, in broad terms, like how much of your business is online now, like in part of the pie chart, let's say?
It's a good percentage of the business. It's about 15%, 10, 12, 15%. It's, we've worked really hard at it to build. We've got a really good web guy in Rob, and he built that website. We didn't have to hire anybody for it. He did a spectacular job on it. Real proud of him for that. Very proud of him for that, actually. And it's just another way to reach clients that either, don't want to drive downtown, don't live in the area, don't live in the city. And you can get information on the product, and they can make their choice. And hopefully it's, navigating the website's easy for them.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. So I'll just make a note to anyone who lives in British Columbia or lives outside of British Columbia, but is interested in gifting someone located in British Columbia some wine. You can order on the Marquee website and have it delivered in British Columbia, your products, for people who aren't familiar. And it's fun to just kind of do a little bit of browsing on the shop. So just, I guess, still kind of on trend. So the digital marketplace is one current trend. But more broadly, and the wine industry and the alcohol beverage industry is really grappling with a lot of things right now, in addition to acute climate events and weather events. But I guess what I wanted to focus in on a little bit is, trends of people drinking less, different demographics, people exploring other things other than wine, like beer, spirits, other refreshments, other intoxicants. Boomers are aging. Maybe they're not collecting as much wine as they used to. They're big wine collectors. What does this mean for your business planning? Who do you think your future customers are? I saw in the last couple of years, you've also started to carry spirits and beer. Like what do you think? I mean, you have a strong following, so maybe you don't feel that you need to tweak too much because there's always going to be wine lovers, or am I wrong there? Time will tell.
Yeah, you can't sit on your laurels. You can't sit on your hands. You always have to tweak, think, adjust. If you get complacent, that's the death of a business. And even at my age, at 64, almost 65, I still have a lot of energy. I still like the business and the people in it and the customers. I mean, it's all about the people. That's how I met you. That's how I met my ex-wife. it's how I've met a ton of friends of mine is through this store. If it was a health food store, if it was a supermarket, maybe. This is just, it's a different thing. So it's pretty cool in that respect. People are drinking less. I think they're drinking better. Again, going back to the organic, the biodynamic, the lutte raisonné, good farming practices, that has a huge, huge thing to deal with it. It's funny, when I used to go to wineries and we talked about biodynamics, we'd be in a cold cellar and we'd be at a dinner table or lunch table. Now that conversation has moved out from the cellars, the wine cellars, and now it's on dinner tables of the average consumer. Again, Dan Buettner has done a great job with the Blue Zones. And I think that's really important. So when people put something in their mouth and in their belly, they want it to taste good, be good, and it grown properly. So if you're going to drink less, fine, I get that. Drink better. Spend the money on it.
Well, less is more, and I'm fine. I've seen that too. Even how people socialize. I think people are anxious to go out again and to support local producers and hospitality partners and restaurants. I think also people are happy to stay at home, go and buy some good food, get a nice bottle of wine, get that craft beer, get that nice non-alc libation, and savor them. 100%. So I think that's kind of back to, I think of other generations in my family, European background. That's what they did on Saturday night. They didn't have a lot of money. They're immigrants to Canada, but they got dressed up. They played bridge. They had martinis, and then they had wine. And it was a good night. So, I think less is more, and I think that's probably across all of the age groups for different reasons.
Absolutely, and wine. Collectible wine's gotten so expensive. So every one customer that's 70, 75, they used to buy, cases of Bordeaux or Burgundy, and I need 10 to replace them because the wines aren't $25 a bottle anymore. They're $235 a bottle. So that's a big problem. And, hopefully just more people fall in love with wine, because at the end of the day, there are humans behind it.
Yeah. And I think it's the story, I agree. There's always going to be passion for the wine and for the story around it. And, I think it's just how people will connect. And I think it will go back to lifestyle and the connection with humans sitting around a table. Maybe we'll be more kind of post-digital or parallel with digital, or, analog, having around a table how wine was meant to be had, which is with food and talking and being together. So I think there is that trend. I guess time will tell about what consumers will want.
For me, it's all about micro trends. I'm not interested in, you know, God, if I could find a $10 wine that tastes like 30, I'd be all over it. But those things are hard to find these days. But it's all about just having a, you know, a good bottle that's got a good story behind it, supporting a family, and knowing that you've, you know, helped supported, you know, a couple of generations of families, whether it's locally or around the world.
Yeah. So, you know, that whole can't find the $10 bottle of wine that tastes like a 30, I think there are probably lots of different reasons for that, and depending where in the world you're sitting. But, you know, in British Columbia, we have lots of things affecting the pricing of our products that you buy here, whether they're domestically produced or imported. And, you know, I know we could spend hours right now on this question. And I know that you have lots of thoughts on it. But I'm just wondering if we could extract just a couple of points in this context, which is, on previous episodes, I've discussed the regulatory regime with winery owners about what our regulations do to hinder right now or fetter their business, whether it's, you know, being able to send wine direct to consumer and their wine club members outside of the province. You know, Mark Hicken has talked a lot about the different regulatory regime that's the hangover from prohibition. You know, but from your perspective as a retailer, you know, what are maybe one or two things, if you could have modified a regulatory relief or changed, you know, this year, you know, what are a few examples, practical examples for people who are not in the industry, who don't know what you might be facing on a day-to-day basis that would really help you run your business or get the wine to your people?
Oh, sell to restaurants.
Yeah.
Number one thing.
Now, maybe can you explain for the listening public who don't know what you can't sell directly to restaurants?
That's
they can't buy from you.
Only government stores can do that.
Right.
They keep that business for themselves.
Yeah.
And they don't want the competition, because you know why? We will kick their ass.
So for people who don't know, people have a bar, a wine bar or a restaurant, they need to go and buy their orders from the liquor store. And, you know, from hearing from people, you know, it's hard if they have a few spec products and they're a small wine bar and they're running out and they only need a couple bottles to get them through a night or a weekend. And, you know, they're hamstrung because they have one supplier that they can go to that they're allowed to buy that.
Let's put this in the context for the listeners out there.
Mm-hmm.
The liquor board forces a restaurant to buy $6 or $12 of an expensive bottle of wine. So that can be anywhere from $300 to $1,000 for that case. And it may take them months to sell that product, as opposed to being able to buy single bottles of those wines off a private liquor store shelf. The analogy I have is that if you walked into any other store, let's call it Safeway, and they said, "Tanya, John, sorry, we can't sell you 3 racks of lamb. You have to buy 42 racks. But there's only 2 of us, sir. Those are the rules. I'm sorry." And so what do? You're forced to go and buy something that you don't want, or a limited selection. And that's what we have today here in this province.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the smacks of paternalism going back to prohibition era. So that, again, are still with us. Right. So just before we wrap, I was wondering whether you would have some pearls of wisdom to share advice for new entrants to the market. By that, I mean, it could be people that are looking to start a new business in the beverage space, but it also could be anyone who's looking to start a new business, whether it's bricks or maybe a bricks and mortar business. You know, just from altitude, you've built one brick at a time, let's just say metaphorically, slow and steady with, you know, obviously lots of great growth and success. But, you know, looking back, if you're going to write John's handbook and there were 2 or 3 chapters or signposts about, you know, to someone, here's how, you know, this is how you should look at starting building a business. You know, what might some of those signposts be?
Honesty and sincerity.
Right.
over deliver, under promise and over deliver. And, you know, there's a great quote by Tony Robbins that has always stuck with me. People underestimate what they can achieve in a lifetime and overestimate what they can achieve in a year. And so slow and steady wins. James Clear wrote something great. 1% better every day is 37.78% better at the end of the year, because the growth is exponential. So cut yourself some slack. Slow and steady wins the race. And we've seen it all in the newspapers, all these companies that have, you know, great evaluations and exponential growth. And what happens to them? They implode. And so, and the business community is just littered with field of unsuccessful businesses, because most businesses don't succeed. So have a plan and benchmark. Talk to people, educate yourself, read the right books, journal, and you will succeed.
Well, John, thank you. Thank you so much for those pearls of wisdom, and also for whenever we catch up, your advice to me and your observations. I always love hearing your vantage point and perspective on the industry and the world at large, and also in terms of where your businesses come from. And thank you for continuing to fight the good fight, as we call it. And I look forward to seeing where Marquee goes in the coming years, and seeing you soon to clink glasses in the Blue Zone.
Sounds good. Thanks, okay. Daniel. Cheers.
Take care. All the best.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to my episode today. I hope you enjoyed hearing a little bit about what it's like to start and run a bricks and mortar bottle shop. Stay tuned for my next episode, which should be dropping in a few weeks from now. Until then, be well, and I look forward to seeing you back here on the TT1 Explorer podcast.